This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. That's the opening of Fanfare for the Common Man, one of Aaron Copland's most famous compositions. It was written in 1942 as one of a series of wartime fanfares commissioned by the Cincinnati Symphony. This year, orchestras around the country are celebrating the centenary of Copland's birth. My guest is the author of a recent biography of Copland, Howard Pollack. He's a professor of music history and literature at the University of Houston. In an era when classical music meant European music, Copland was determined to create a distinctly American sound, which he succeeded in doing by drawing on jazz, folk music, and hymns. Some of his most famous music was written for ballets, such as Rodeo, Billy the Kid, and Appalachian Spring. Let's start with one of his early works, which shows the influence of jazz. It was written in 1925, when Copland was 25. This is an excerpt of Music for the Theater. Howard Pollack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
You know, although Copland is so loved for writing music that really sounds like America, he was accused of being anti-American during the red-baiting era of the 1950s. You cover some of that in your biography of Copland, and you say that for him this kind of started in 1949 with a Life magazine article that singled him and about 49 other people out. This was an article called "Red Visitors Cause Rumpus, Dupes and Fellow Travelers Dress Up Communist Fronts." This was an article about a World Peace Conference in New York that featured photos of 50 of the conference's best-known participants, including Copland, Bernstein, Charles Chaplin, Einstein, Lillian Hellman, Thomas Mann, and Arthur Miller. What was the importance of this article?
Well, it was a landmark article in the history of the anti-communist hysteria that gripped America during these years, and it was a tremendous personal embarrassment for Copland. He never dreamed that his participation in this event could be interpreted in this way. It didn't augur very well for the next few years.
Copland was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. How did he handle himself when he was interrogated?
Oh, he handled himself as he always did, with extreme poise and calm. And I think he very successfully managed to disarm Joe McCarthy and the other members of that committee.
Did he name names?
He did not name names and was very clever about sort of getting around the request for naming names. For instance, I think they... there was a question asked about his participation in an event. It might have been the World Peace Conference. I don't recall offhand. And he said, "I don't remember seeing anybody there that wasn't mentioned in the newspaper." So that was the sort of very sly and clever way he handled the committee.
Were there attempts to suppress his music during this period?
There were a few. The most notorious was the removal of Lincoln Portrait from the inaugural concert, from the Eisenhower inaugural concert in 1952. The Congress thought that someone with these type of questionable associations, these questionable leftist associations, should not have his music performed at an inaugural concert. And it was meant, this decision was met with great outrage and satirical comments by the press, by and large, because people knew that this whole thing was a sham. Lincoln Portrait is one of the great works of American music, and a very profoundly, you know, stirring setting of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and other of Lincoln's statements. But politicians really didn't know Copeland very well and just went along with the hysteria that was, as I said, gripping America at the time.
What were Copeland's politics?
Copeland was definitely a man of the left. He was very concerned about the common man. He wrote a fanfare, a very famous fanfare for the common man. And I think that was one of the great motivating aspects of his life, his work as an artist, his work in the social arena as a conductor, as a writer, were all geared toward raising the standards and the of the arts in America, making art available to Americans, fostering good music in America. I think this all had a sort of social and political subtext and connection.
I'm wondering if the staunch anti-communists and the people on the House Un-American Activity Committee knew that Copeland was gay, something that they also probably would have been hysterical about.
There's no evidence of that in the FBI file, but it's very possible that they did. He didn't make a great secret of being gay.
Now, you write a bit about Copeland's homosexuality, and you say that he accepted that himself at a pretty young age, at a time when a lot of gay people didn't accept homosexuality because it was so unaccepted by the world around them. What evidence do you have that he was comfortable with his own sexual orientation?
The primary evidence consists of statements that his very good friend Harold Clurman made. Harold Clurman was the great director and drama critic. There's a Harold Clurman Theater in New York. And Clurman and Copeland were roommates. They were cousins. They were also roommates in Paris from 1921 to 1924. So Clurman is one of his oldest friends and wrote about Copeland's acceptance of his homosexuality. Other composers, writers who entered his circle either intimated or stated or spoke about Copeland's comfort with his homosexuality and how important that was for them, because he was someone, whether they were gay or straight, he was someone that they could turn to for support because he was so confident with himself and had such self-assurance about his own person.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard Pollack, the author of a biography of Aaron Copeland. Pollack is also a professor of music at the University of Houston. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Howard Pollack, the author of a biography of Aaron Copeland. He's also a professor of music at the University of Houston. One of the things I find almost paradoxical about Copeland is that on the one hand, he's writing, you know, American music. And by American music, this often translates to music of the West, you know, like Rodeo and Billy the Kid. And then there's, you know, like Mexican themes running through some of his music. And there's Copeland himself, who's, you know, the son of Russian immigrants. He's Jewish. He's gay. He's from Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, I know he wants to write like American music, but what's his connection to the West, you know, to the American West? Was he ever even in that part of the country?
He was in that part of the country. And everyone in America, I think, knows about the West. He grew up with watching Westerns, And silent films, and
I always think of Westerns as being later on. I guess he could have watched those Western silent films. I don't want people to take this the wrong way. I'm not trying to say, where did he get off as a Jewish homosexual from Brooklyn writing about the West? But it's rather, how did he feel so connected to it when it really wasn't a part of his personal background?
Well, the importance of the West is perhaps, in a way, exaggerated by the fact that some of his most famous pieces are on Western themes that were written for choreographers who were writing ballets about the West. If one looks at the total output of Copland's music, the West really doesn't figure very prominently. But because of the prominence of Billy the Kid and Rodeo and Appalachian Spring, three ballets he wrote in succession in the late 1930s and early 1940s, his name, I think, forever will be associated with the West.
And again, this is because he was commissioned to write these pieces.
He was commissioned to write them. There's a comical story about discussing Rodeo with Agnes DeMille, and Agnes DeMille outlined her idea about this cowboy ballet. Copland had already written a cowboy ballet, Billy the Kid, and thought one cowboy ballet in a lifetime is enough, and was rather resistant. And Agnes DeMille, in trying to win him over, said, but it will have something of what Martha Graham, who was her friend, what Martha Graham calls race memory. To which Copland responded, well, why then don't we do a ballet about Ellis Island, referring to the fact that Agnes DeMille had a Jewish grandmother who is the mother of Cecil B. DeMille, the great film director. And so Copland was rather ironic about this. However, Agnes DeMille won him over. She had created this wonderful comic persona as a cowgirl who was a little bit big in the hips and didn't move that gracefully, and it was a wonderful comic persona. And she convinced Copland to write a ballet for that persona, for that stage character, and Copland responded with Rodeo.
Well, why don't we hear a passage from Rodeo? What should we hear? Hoedown?
Hoedown sounds great.
Okay. And this is Leonard Bernstein conducting. Leonard Bernstein conducting Aaron Copland's Rodeo. My guest is Howard Pollack, who's written a biography of Aaron Copland, and he's a professor of music at the University of Houston. What was his attitude toward Hollywood when he was writing movie music? And before you answer that, tell us some of the best scores that he wrote for movies.
He wrote five Hollywood scores, Of Mice and Men, including Of Mice and Men, Our Town, The North Star, The Heiress, and The Red Pony, and all of them won Academy Award nominations, finally won by the last film, The Heiress. Copland had a very balanced view of life, including film music. He recognized that most people were hearing in America and maybe around the world were hearing orchestral music in the movie house. So he recognized the importance of film music in American society and in world society. That made him very interested in trying his hand out as a film composer. That said, he also recognized that there were a lot of pitfalls for a serious idealistic artist like himself in Hollywood, and he kind of proceeded very carefully in his Hollywood career, making sure he would be working with certain directors and making sure he'd be working on certain projects. And in fact, a very unpleasant incident about The Heiress was one of the reasons probably he gave up writing films, film scores for Hollywood.
What was that incident?
The opening title music that he had written, which is very, very strong, powerful music to help set the mood for this really wonderful film adaptation of the Henry James story, was rewritten by a studio hack into a kind of a schmaltzy, typical Hollywood opening. And if you watch The Heiress, you'll notice that when the titles read music by Aaron Copland, the score suddenly changes, and it's like somebody's just thrown cold water over you, because that's the beginning of Copland's own score and his own music, which is much more severe and hard-edged than one had heard up until that point. Copland was so disgusted with Hollywood for doing that he wrote, he just publicly criticized the studios, and this probably led to such bad feelings that it became difficult for him to work in Hollywood. Not that people did not ask him to work in the ensuing years.
Let's hear the opening music from The Heiress as audiences heard it when watching the movie, and then we'll hear what Copland intended, and we'll hear that conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Aaron Copland's theme for The Heiress, as he composed it, preceded by the rewritten version used on the soundtrack of the film. My guest Howard Pollack is the author of a recent biography of Aaron Copland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This year marks the centenary of Aaron Copland's birth. My guest Howard Pollack is the author of a biography of the composer. The Copland work that we've been hearing has, for the most part, been his really accessible, popular music. Now, he also wrote some more contemporary-sounding classical music, using like the 12-tone row, for instance. Some people think of that as being kind of out of character for him, or being less important or less interesting than his more, say, jazz-oriented work and his dance suites. Why don't we hear the very ending of his piece Connotations for Orchestra, which was commissioned in 1962 to open what was then called Philharmonic Hall and is now Avery Fisher Hall, which is part of Lincoln Center. What are your thoughts about the ending of this piece and the importance of this piece in his larger output of work?
Well, Connotations represents in a way the extreme of this spectrum, because it really is one of the thorniest and most difficult works of Copland. Every once in a while, he gave in to a work that seemed to express a good deal of violence and harshness, people have interpreted this is as Copland taking stock of the world that we live in, and it's not always nostalgic reflections of a previous day, but rather gritty reflections on our own day. And I think Connotations falls into that category.
And the end, you know, challenging as it may be, the end is really rousing and noisy and interesting.
Copland's always noisy, I think. This is one of the earmarks of his music, is it's extremely vital and vibrant with lots of percussion instruments. And his music often concludes in this sort of arousing way.
Okay, here's the end of Aaron Copland's Connotations for Orchestra. The ending of Aaron Copland's Connotations for Orchestra as conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein and Copland had a very important musical relationship. Bernstein conducted a lot of Copland. He premiered some of Copland's pieces. Would you tell us a little bit more about their relationship to each other, what they thought of each other musically?
Copland was by far the most important person professionally in Leonard Bernstein's career, especially as a composer. Bernstein discovered Copland's music while he was still in college. They became personal buddies when Bernstein, again, was still in college. And Copland really mentored Bernstein, and Bernstein developed a musical style that grew directly out of Copland's music. West Side Story, for instance, is inconceivable without the example of Copland's music. So Bernstein was one of many American composers who had an enormous debt to Copland as a composer.
What do you know? What he thought of, say, West Side Story, which is a really wonderful work. You know, the score for that, but it is very, very much out of Copland.
Copland did not write very much about Bernstein's music. His only extended piece on Bernstein is an earlier work in which he sort of criticizes the eclecticism of his music, but praises its vigor and panache. He predicts in the late 40s, from when this article is from, that Bernstein's greatest success is likely to be in the theater. So he was right on that score.
Mm-hmm. Copland died in 1990 at the age of 90. He had suffered a form of dementia for several years. Did the public know about that?
The public really didn't know about his dementia. It was more or less, you know, kept from public view. There were a few late episodes in Copland's career when it was clear that he did not have all his faculties, and the press were beginning to comment on that. And at a certain point, he just had no contact with the public.
Do you know if during that period he had any music abilities left, whether he listened to music or could play, if he took any pleasure in music?
he did take pleasure in music. People report that he would tap his fingers listening to music, or tap even without listening to music. You know, the pianist's habit of kind of tapping his fingers on the keyboard. He listened to music, and he seemed to enjoy hearing music, and would smile, and to the end kept a certain very agreeable countenance about him that he was always known for, this kind of toothy, grinny, smiling face that everyone knows to be Copland's public face.
Would you like to choose a piece for us to close with, a piece that you particularly love, that you'd like to share with us?
I have to admit a special fondness for Appalachian Spring. As popular as that work is, it's a work that one can go back to time and time again and hear something new always.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about Aaron
Copland. It's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Howard Pollack is the author of Aaron Copland, The Life and Work of an Uncommon Man. Pollack is a professor at the University of Houston.